Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared create collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next interview is with Lisa Fiorelli, and she's a research and policy professional who has quite a few years' experience working in the Canadian arts and culture sector. But her experience has kind of spanned public and not-for-profit fields and worlds, and she really is passionate about data. And it doesn't, you know, on the surface, I suppose, sound all that exciting, but it's really quite fascinating what Lisa and I ended up having a conversation about. We basically talked about the value of arts and culture to not only our economy, but also to just society at large. I mean, there really are global implications here. Workinculture.ca. That's workinculture.ca. And listen in for a conversation about, this existential question of who actually really is an artist. We talk about diversity and inclusion, and we talk about why this work is not really all that easy, and why it isn't just about passion, and how people really do, and I this certainly resonates with me. I mean, don't most of us want to feel valued in what we do? And we talk about the societal perception of art, and we talk about how it, you know, again, makes contact with reality in meaningful ways around us, and frankly, in ways that we probably don't even know or aren't even that aware of. So Lisa's been working with Work in Culture and has been trying to take these numbers, these stats, and make them connect to actual human beings, to people that matter, to people that are actually getting the work done, and then what are the implications of that data, and where can we go from here? So listen in, Lisa Fiorelli coming right up. Don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my writing, my public speaking. You can certainly book me there. You can also get access to my copy of my book, Real Change is Incremental. I'm actually working on something new, and I'm going to be letting you hopefully know about that in the very near future. I've got a bit of a pitch coming up. It's on relationships and relationship management, and I'm going to be talking about that a little bit more down the road. But you can purchase a copy of Real Change is Incremental online on my website, davidpecklive.com. And don't forget facetofacelive.ca for a whole slew of other podcasts from the Toronto International Film Festival. We've got a lot of really neat things coming up for 2020 as well. You can advertise with us. You can sign up for our newsletter. Please forward these podcasts along to other people. Follow us on social media. If you can, and might even be willing to consider it, supporting what we do here, you can do that through patreon.com. We do have a few supporters now, not too many supporters yet, but, you know, we're building, and you can advertise with us too. So reach out to us if you're interested in doing that. There's banner ads. We can embed you in podcasts. We can get you into the newsletters. There's a variety of different ways we can grow your online audience as well. And if you can't do any of those things, if you could leave us a review, if you like what we're doing here at Face to Face, please do leave us a review at iTunes. We sure would appreciate it. And also, don't forget rabble.ca, a whole host of other thinkers and writers and bloggers and podcasters making contact with reality in meaningful ways. Rabble.ca, news for the rest of us. Face to Face appears there as well. Stay tuned for a very interesting conversation about data and how it makes us better humans and how it connects to art and culture and things that matter. Lisa Fiorelli coming right up. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest with us here today. Lisa Fiorelli is here to, I'm going to let her tell you what she's here for, but she's with Work in Culture. That's workinculture.ca. And make sure you check them out on Twitter and Facebook as well. We're probably going to be doing a few more of those shout outs as we go. But Lisa, thank you for your time today. So I appreciate you joining us here on Face to Face.
Oh, really happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So you are a research and outreach manager. You've worked with Work in Culture for a couple of years. Love to hear a little bit more about that and what you're managing. And what is exactly Work in Culture? I'm going to assume that some of our listeners don't know. In fact, probably most of them don't. And how can we step into, you know, what you do? And let's not get into the data yet, but tell us a little bit more about Work in Culture.
Absolutely. So Work in Culture is a art service organization. We're a not-for-profit based in Toronto, but we cover Ontario as a whole. Our mandate is really to help the people that work in the cultural sector. So we define that really widely, anywhere from artists to people who work more on maybe the admin side, whether they're in the not-for-profit or on the for-profit side. And we help them just manage their careers. So the business skills that they might need, any sort of entrepreneurial training. So we do a lot of workshops on things like, you know, financial planning for artists or business planning, down to, you know, how do you manage volunteers? How do you enact diversity and inclusion policies? So really the type of training that's often lacking. A lot of people we find in the sector self-identify sometimes at being bad at business, but really they just need a reframing of some of the business concepts. So we try to help them get there. Now, most people that interact with us probably do so through our job board. It's one of the bigger ones in Ontario for arts and cultural work. So we have a really big interest in understanding the cultural sector and advocating for it.
So typically when people think of artists, it seems to me, I've got a background and maybe some people will roll their eyes at this, but I do sleight of hand magic. And so I've been performing magic for years and there's been this sort of ongoing debate about, oh, are magicians, you know, artists, or are they more, is this a crowd, is a juggler an artist, is a, you know, are variety acts artists? So can you talk a bit how you guys define that a little bit more? It's not just visual art, it's not just music, this could be spoken word. I mean, it's a pretty diverse space, it seems to me, and I think it represents, according to your study, close to 280,000 Canadians. Is that right?
It does, yeah. And I think who is an artist is like an existential question facing the sector.
that's fantastic. I love it. Yeah, I would agree with that, by the way. That's hilarious.
As a researcher, I tend to probably like neat definitions, and this is definitely a project where a neat definition is just fundamentally impossible. It is close to, it's 275,000 people, so close to 280. So it's a pretty sizable chunk of Ontario's workforce. And it really
includes— Oh, right. Sorry. I said Canada. Sorry. That's 280,000 in Ontario.
In Ontario. Yeah. It's defining the arts and who participates in it, even whether we use the term artist or cultural worker, which also appears in the report. It's really difficult. We do mean people that are, you know, what I would describe as sort of producing art. So people who are visual artists, musicians, so people who are actively creating works of art. Those are certainly included in our bucket. But we also refer to people who are culture sector workers or arts administrators, they're sometimes referred to. So people that might work in jobs like mine, who they don't produce any art, but we're a part of that ecosystem that facilitates the creation of art. It could be people working, you know, in a museum, in a gallery, in a library. And then, you know, that's just the non-for-profit sort of side. There's also, you know, the cultural industry. So people working in film and television as producers, or, you know, work in finance at a film company. And people that work across music, book publishing, magazine publishing, interactive digital media, so a lot of video games, VR production, and the other buckets in the report also include heritage and libraries, so museums. The report primarily refers to the public sector side of that. So, you know, your largest museums, the AGO, you know, the Science Center, those sorts of places, as well as libraries. So the public sector side of the libraries in this report specifically. So it wouldn't include.
So Lisa, I think that the question is, is clowning considered an art form?
I don't think it's
just to go a little existential on you there.
I don't think it specifically was in this report, but it could be. I don't know. I'm not against it for future iterations of the report. We did rely pretty much on four large buckets. So the arts, traditionally understood to be like visual arts and sort of dance and performing arts, cultural industries, heritage, and libraries. So we're also often relying on Statistics Canada, which is not a perfect system for defining the arts either. But right. No, the short right. answer is no. Yeah.
So what's interesting, I would love to chat with you too, just briefly, if you don't mind, about, you know, your comment there about Statistics Canada and reliability. What about the study and this type of data? Does your organization then help to inform, the Canada Arts Council, for instance, heritage programs? Is that sort of where this info goes and why it's so important?
Yeah, I think it harkens back to that sort of existential question. A lot of the issues with defining the sector and figuring out who's included and who's not is really, really fundamental work for the sector. You know, a lot of the sector is serviced by places like the Ontario Arts Council or Canada Council for the Arts, so relies on grant funding. A lot of that is making a case for yourself as an industry or as an organization. And having a sense of even just how many employees that organization have is really right. integral to making a case for yourself for funding, So us having this data and creating this data is sort of trying to make a contribution to that. We as an organization don't really engage in that sort of like advocacy or lobbying activity directly. But we hope that, you know, by putting this data out there and sort of taking a bit of a different approach than people traditionally use to measure this data, we're hoping to make an important contribution there. We think that having this data in this format and some of that really important demographic information is really important to understand the sector. And it's a good snapshot of where we are. I think, you know, going forward, we do want to update it. We do want to tweak it. We'd like to get as accurate as possible with the existing frameworks and limitations that we have. In terms of quantifying the sector, I mean, a big one for us in this report is, you know, how do we quantify freelance workers or self-employed workers if we're relying on Statistics Canada data? It's really difficult. So that's sort of some of the questions we're grappling with. But we hope that, you know, the report can really give people a sense of where we are in Ontario and what that population looks like.
So is making it work made up of former artists or budding artists or artists themselves who care a great deal about, you know, raging against the machine, you could say, speaking to the status quo? Is that sort of what's driving this? Or would you say it's statisticians, or is it just people purely who care about this kind of work and see an important contribution that artists of all kinds make? Does that question make sense?
Oh, it's a good question. I think it's all three in some ways. So what we did with the report is, you know, we started off with the numbers portion. So we hired a firm called Nordicity. They put together the report. They did a lot of the research work. And I worked with them pretty closely on this. They started with looking at the Statistics Canada data, but using some of the definitions that Stats Canada traditionally used to describe the arts, but applying them to the census, which is, you know, the biggest piece of data we have about Canadians. And sort of filter it from there. So they took a bit of an innovative approach. So a lot of, you know, crunching the numbers to get a sense of, you know, what is actually the demographic breakdown of the sector? What do incomes look like from that amount of data? We know it's not perfect because we know it probably doesn't do a great job of capturing like freelance and self-employed people just because of the way the census is structured. So we also launched a survey. So we probably did get a lot of people who did, you know, want to fill in a survey to tell us about their working environments, to tell us about the income that they generate, or lack thereof. So there is probably a bit of that. And, you know, we also probably got a bit of that rage against the machine just from talking to people. We held some roundtables, like there's a lot of positive that came out of roundtables, but, you know, you get people together to talk about the state of the workforce. And certainly, you know, we hear a lot about what the workforce is like and what it's like to work in culture, you know, what the challenges people are having. We heard a lot about opportunities for sure. But we went to 10 cities and talked to people and had very frank discussions about, you know, the state of the workforce. Do they find staying in the arts as a sustainable career? Like, what are some of the challenges facing them as people or, you know, within their organizations? And some of the recommendations speak to that, I think. So yeah, I think it's a little bit of everything. There's a lot of people heavily involved and interested in the statistical part of it and the survey findings, but people are really interested in the narrative and the qualitative part of the study as well, from what I've found since we released it.
Would you say that, making it work, and this is a, I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but would you say that you are more interested in the, you know, the artistic contribution that these individuals have to make, museums, libraries, artists, et cetera, spoken word artists, visual musicians, however you define that existentially, or is it more, and it's not that binary, I understand that, but or is it more about supporting those people in order for them to do their work and to create a space for them to, you know, live and move and breathe and you know, business, you know, build capacity, essentially, I suppose. So in other words, you guys almost become advocates for them in a sense by creating, mm-hmm. you know, these types of reports and this type of training and so on.
Yeah, I think for us, it's more the latter. I think we see this report as a tool. I think as a research person, obviously I like research for the sake of research, but I do see that the life of this report and the meaning of this report is really in how people apply it and how people use it. We want to give people the information that empowers them. So whether it's, you know, they could look at this report and pull something out of it that helps them with grant writing. We would love that. That'd be my dream situation, that somebody can use something from here and, you know, get a project done that they've been meaning to get done.
Right, right. It's not just numbers for the sake of numbers and it goes on a shelf and people refer to it academically, but this actually makes a difference in somebody's life.
Yeah. And I think something we heard that really resonated with me as an individual is a lot of people felt that their issues in the cultural sector were tied to just the overall perception of the value of cultural work. So people felt like they were underappreciated because, you know, people don't think this is a real job. People think we do this for love and exposure, but this is like a career that I'm trying to make a career. I need to pay my mortgage, I need to pay my rent. I have skills. Like, these are digital skills. Like, these are, you know, people like to feel valued in what they do. So I think part of that advocacy strategy for us, at least going forward, is just, you know, reinforcing that, like, this is a very highly skilled workforce. This is young, energetic people. These are, you know, it varies in terms of demographics. It's a little bit younger than the overall workforce in Ontario, but it's not just about the youth either. But this is an interesting workforce with skills of the future and skills that are not necessarily easily automated. Creativity and problem solving is not always something that could be, you know, taken over by AI in 5 years. Like, these are important skills that we want people to have. And how do we better support them, I think, is a question for us as an organization and as a sector. Like, how do we make sure that people understand that, you know, working in the arts doesn't actually only mean that you're a starving artist. Like, there are people making it work in the sector, like, to rely on the title a bit. But, like, there are people who are making this work for themselves and they're finding new and innovative ways to sustain their career. So I think we just want people to, you know, take a look at the data and maybe have their impression of the sector changed a little bit. Like, there's a lot we have to work on, but there's certainly a lot of positive, I think, from the report.
So I was actually quite surprised to see that the average salary was over $40,000 a year, and that 80% of the people that you surveyed were getting their incomes from art related activities. I mean, that kind of buoyed my spirits a little bit. I mean, is that a fair place to go, would you say, or are we a long way away from people being able to sustain families and so on, you know, through the cultural sector?
I think it's a moving target. I think in some segments of the report do better at that than others. I would say that the largest sample, especially from the surveys in the cultural industries, so sort of that for-profit music industry, publishing, which the salaries tended to be higher. Certainly people that are working in the art sector as practicing artists aren't experiencing that level of salary. I think once we exclude the cultural industries from the sample, it drops down to about $34,000 a year, which, at least if they live in Toronto, is not a sustainable salary. I think it's not as I was expecting the overall average to be lower when I started out this work. So I was happily surprised. I think there's a lot of room to grow and there's a lot of improvement that needs to be made. And people are certainly concerned about their sustainability in the sector. A lot of what we heard, especially in the roundtable, was people, you know, they get to a certain point in their lives where they want to have a child, they want to buy a house, and they're not finding that's possible in the sector. So we have to figure out how we get people to stay in the sector and what changes need to be made. But I would say that, yeah, it's it's hard to get one average, I guess, that speaks to 275,000 people.
Well, and overall, it's such a thing about perspective. I mean, where do you live? I mean, over $40,000 a year. What does that actually mean, depending on how many people are in your family and so on? And it just, I guess, I often hear comedians, variety acts mostly, I guess, talk about how, oh, gee, we got to move to the U.S. or what a different market it is there. And it's just, it's kind of, you know, it's I guess it's not surprising in some respects. It's a bigger market and mm-hmm. it seems like there's more opportunities. But you'd like to think that in the age of, you know, this global village, supposedly, I say that in quotes or put it in italics, that we live in, you would like to think there are other, you know, there are newer opportunities coming up, you know, YouTube and so on. And what, you know, are there other ways of for people who work within the sector to maybe not just offset their income, but actually grow it? I don't know. Maybe that's just a massive oversimplification, but just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
No, I think that's an important part of the puzzle as well. When we looked at the type of skills that people wanted to learn, they thought they needed to develop their career further, a lot of it was around, you know, marketing and communicating impact and figuring out, you know, just figuring out the importance of what they're doing and how to talk about it better. I think we see a lot of, you know, people who are interested in export generally. People really do want to figure out a way, you know, we live in an age with all of these platforms, they need to figure out how to use Etsy to sell their craft better and what skills they need. And often what it comes down to, especially if you're an independent artist, is that you really need five jobs. You're not just being the creator, but you're also your own social media person, website developer, accountant, you know, marketing expert. So people are, you know, people are trying to find a way to make it work, I think. I think the question of geography is a big one. Depending where you are, the situation is very different. Like, we had roundtables in places, you know, as small as Owen Sound, and we had roundtables in Toronto. Like, the situation is quite different. Toronto people were very concerned about, you know, gentrification and the cost of living and things like that, where Owen Sound were trying to, you know, find a way to make this a sustainable career, and people had carved out really interesting work for themselves. But, you know, everybody kind of wants to be more interconnected and everybody's sort of looking for the same skills, just probably at different levels and different types of them. But certainly, yeah, dealing with YouTube for musicians, like these are the sorts of things we get a lot of requests on, and direct people to resources to help them with that. But yeah, I think navigating a global environment is something that it's an opportunity and a challenge, I guess, for our workforce.
Well, there's so much about it too that we don't know. I mean, I've been doing podcasting now for I guess maybe informally for over 5.5 years or something like that, coming up on 450 published interviews. I mean, it is wonderful, and it's a huge sort of milestone, but wow, it's a lot of work. It's a challenge. This is not what I do full time. And how do people cross over to that, you know, start generating income, and how do you know what I mean? Like, there's just so many aspects to it. The social media side of it, of course, there's the editing, all of it's part of the craft, part of the art, however you look at it, you got to do the research. It's and if I want money, maybe I need to write some proposals. So yeah, it's complex, and it's a challenge. And I think artists are, they're not always going to be great at, you could put anyone in this category, but just because you're, excuse me, a great artist doesn't mean you're going to be a great accountant and a great social media.
Yeah.
Sorry, person.
And we try to give people, you know, with our training, we try to give people, we're not trying to turn the artist, you know, into an accountant. We would just like to give them, you know, the basics that can help them. Maybe, you know, it just improves their next grant application, or maybe it just improves their next marketing campaign. Just give them a little bit of that practical education that can go a long way. You don't want to take the art out of the person, but I think sometimes you need a bit of the business skill to just, if you want to make this a sustainable career for yourself, it's, no one said it's going to be easy, but there are certain things you could do that are within your purview to sort of learn and, you know, just supplement what you're doing with your art. I think we see a lot of that and a lot of desire for that. People, you know, they know it's not going to be easy and they will need to be their own marketing person for a bit. And, you know, maybe hopefully they'll grow the career to a point where they can hire someone to help with this. But at least at the beginning, especially, like, people do need a lot of support, and we're happy to provide that. Like, most of our stuff is for free as well. You know, it's not easy. I think the report talks a lot about some of the challenges people are facing. But we certainly had people that were very excited and very proud to work in the sector, and we're trying to do good.
Did you find stepping away from this, and maybe this is connected to the financial side of things? I mean, I've written many, many proposals over the years because of some of the work that I do and have done, and they're tough. They're really hard. I mean, you need data, you need research, you need budgets, you need to bring other people in, it seems. Did you step away from the report saying this should be easier?
That's a good question. I think I walked away from the report wondering how we can make it easier as an organization. I guess that's the question that's been sort of stuck in my head since we released it in May. What's working culture? I think people often assume we're bigger of an organization than we really are. We're six people. You know, we don't offer any funding. We're a nonprofit fighting for the same pie as everyone else is. I think we've done a lot of navel gazing on what our role is to make this a little bit better for someone. Right. We want our research to have meaning. We want people to walk away from this as not thinking, okay, they did a report, cool, that's great, and then forget about it in 6 months. So we're actually going to be rolling out some new programming in the next coming months to sort of address some of the skills gaps or like the major recommendations of the report. But certainly, like, what can we do to make this a better place to work? And what can we do to enable other people to, you know, just fight some of these like misconceptions about the sector that people have, and give people a little bit more confidence to talk about. You know, we're 275,000 people. That's a pretty big workforce. There's, you know, there are 4 in 5 culture sector workers have some form of post-secondary credential. Like, these, I think these things go against some of the myths that we do have about the sector. So it's a good question. I don't have a great answer, but this is something that's definitely, all the time right now.
Well, absolutely. It's not an easy question. And I don't necessarily think there's a black and white answer, but you know, things like insurance and support and capacity building and access, I suppose, to opportunity when you're working on your own. You know, you've got your home office in your bedroom and maybe the local coffee shop down the road, you know, I mean, these are wonderful. I've been a consultant. There's freedom in that, but there's also, you know, there's also access issues, if you know what I mean. You're not developing in other ways. There's not necessarily a community around you, and so on. So I think, you know, I think our artists, I think Canadian artists, Ontario artists, do need our support. And wouldn't it be wonderful if others would be able to, you know, see a report like this and say, you know what, this is a large portion of the province of Canada, really, if you extrapolate, if you extend this out elsewhere, because I would imagine this applies in other towns and cities and places around the world. What does that now mean, right? If there's this many people doing this kind of work, I think we need to start asking some other questions, it seems to me.
I think, yeah, it's an opportunity to step back, I think, and take a look at our workforce. I guess one of my bigger fears is, just judging by the income and the demographic makeup of the sector, that this becomes a sector where you can't afford to be working in it unless you have something to fall back on. And we don't want it to become a sector that you can only participate in if you can afford the opportunity cost of what else you could be doing.
Well, you know, I can afford to do, I can be a podcaster because my wife's a real estate agent, or, you know, that, you know what I mean? Wouldn't it be, I mean, and again, is this just a dream that we have here that we're talking about, Lisa? I mean, is this just idealistic and silly because, you know, they don't, artists don't generate enough tax, you know, you don't want to go sideways and all cynical, but you do have to start to wonder.
Yeah, you do. I think it's a fair question. I think it speaks to some of the things we've heard regarding sort of inclusion and diversity in the sector, like who can afford to be here and who can afford to be in this room doing art. It's a valid question. I think some of it's, you know, some of it's living in the world in 2019 and sort of, you know, dealing with cost of housing and cost of space to work. Like, those are huge issues that, you know, work and culture can't really change. But I think we can, maybe some of it at least I think is in our hands to sort of look reflectively and what are ways that we can perpetuate better situations for people and not make it that they have to give up so much to be in the sector. I think a concrete example of what I'm talking about is our job board recently made it mandatory to post salary ranges. So employers, when they're posting a job, have to include salary ranges. It's a very small step, but I think pay equity is something that is important in a sector where incomes vary so much and people are working at very small organizations, and we want to make sure that people are being paid fairly for their wages. And I think it's historically a difficult conversation, not just in the arts, in lots of nonprofit situations as well. There's a whole decent work movement, you know, that we support. And that's a little step we've taken sort of to start to have this conversation. But I think it's something important to keep in mind. We do, in fact, want people to want to work in the sector, but you don't want it to be a situation where you can only work here if you're already rich, or, you know, you've married someone and that can afford to subsidize you. I think taking a look at what we're doing as a sector is also important.
Yeah, you don't need a rich uncle just to be an artist.
We shouldn't, yeah.
Yeah, you shouldn't have to be, or stumble across a pot of gold while walking down the street. Yeah, I mean, it does seem to be sort of like that to some degree. And like I said, I've heard this, got to move to the U.S. And it's just, there's something kind of unsettling about that, it seems to me. What did you find most surprising about this? Anything that really sort of made you step back when it, you know, you talk about loving data and so on, any real anomalies there?
That's a good question. I think one of the bigger things that stick out to me is how many people were earning 80% of their annual income from arts related activities. Like, we have, there's a lot of data already out there about average salaries of artists, whether it's anecdotal or survey based. But I think what's more important is not necessarily the salary bracket people are in, but how much of their income they're actually able to get from their primary occupation. I think it speaks to the way the sector is changing, the way it engages with the gig economy. So I'd be interested in the next few years to keep taking a look at that percentage and see how it changes across demographics. Right. It can, even anecdotally in like my circle, a lot of people are, you know, they're getting some of their money from their arts activities, but they're branching out into things like consulting, or they're branching out into, you know, teaching if they're a musician, or they have some other job to supplement. We're seeing a little bit more of that fragmentation. So be interesting, you know, we know it's happening anecdotally and it's hard to collect that data. So I'd like to keep asking that question if we can. Figuring out what are people doing and how are they getting that other 20%, and seeing if that number changes over time.
That makes a lot of sense. What would you say that money ranked pretty high?
Money
as far as concerns, yeah. Money and capacity building, maybe money and training.
Yeah, I think money was the most commonly cited issue facing culture sector workers. Salary, low income was what was identified. And on the organizational sites, we asked the same questions, but to people who opted to identify as an organization, if they were a senior manager or above. But keeping pace with salary expectations was also, so it was a common problem across the sector. It's not always also, I think, something I've been trying to clarify a lot lately. Sometimes it's not actually the number in the salary. There are a lot of jobs in the sector that do pay reasonably well. The people were concerned about the precariousness of the job. So it wasn't that they're low paid. They were fine with salary, but, you know, they didn't know if the job would actually be there next March.
Right.
There's that element of as well that I think was something to keep note of in the report. And people were also a really major one, and on both sides. So whether people were, you know, independent artists or whether they worked at a larger organization, work-life balance was something that kept coming up. And people were finding a lot of encroachment on work-life balance, which makes sense. You know, if you're an individual artist trying to, you know, be your own accountant, like, do you ever really have a minute to not be working? But I think we saw it a lot.
You kind of never stop. It's, you know, I know when I worked as a consultant, there was, you know, offices at home. If you got out to the local coffee shop or you had a meeting, you sort of broke away from it, but you were always on. Mm-hmm. There was another proposal. There was someone else to research, because this is directly tied to my weekly income. And yeah, it's, I mean, how could it be otherwise in a way? I mean, I would say that, and what's kind of a tragedy to me, and you guys must have a lot of conversations around this. I would think this comes up with, you know, your leadership and your board and so on, but isn't it a tragedy that the artist, the cultural worker is being taken away from the work that they, you know, are being driven to do, because they're, you know, they lack the entrepreneurial skill, which, you know, it's part of life. I get it. But I guess it sort of comes down to the importance. And I think that's what's interesting for me when this first came, you know, into my inbox and started to read through it was, where do you put art? Where do you put culture? Where do you put libraries and museums in, you know, the scheme of things? How important it is to you as a, well, here in Canada, as a province, as a government, as an individual, as a family, how do you approach that with your kids and as you teach and so on? I think for me, that's the bigger implication that comes out of this. I don't know where you stand on that, but that's certainly one of my takeaways.
Yeah, that's an important takeaway. And that sort of speaks to, you know, people thought that a lot of the challenges they were facing was, it's based on the societal perception of the value of art. An interesting anecdote that we got at one of the roundtables was, this organization had historically gone into high schools to talk to people about creative careers, but they were finding a lot of resistance because kids would say, you know, my parents want me to work in this other industry where I'm going to make money.
Right. You can be an artist as long as you get a real job as well.
Yeah. And you combat a bit of that. And I think Working Culture does some work as well with post-secondary education institutions. And I remember getting questions about that from one of the students that I was paired up with, like a speed networking thing, and trying to make the point that, you know, just because there are lots of jobs in the arts. I think people have a very specific image when you say arts and culture. They do think of an artist, which is great because that's the heart of what we're trying to do. But, you know, there are marketing professionals, there are accountants, like truly a wealth of skill in the sector. Just because, you know, the job doesn't exist today doesn't mean it won't exist in 6 months. Like virtual reality, like there's lots of really interesting work to be done. And I think the value proposition is really just talking to people more about what we do in the arts. And, you know, sometimes that argument has to be economic. Sometimes it's, you know, we have a pretty significantly large workforce. We do contribute to the economy. We generate tourism dollars. Like we are, we have lots of jobs. We have heft there, but also there's, you know, the sociocultural benefits. We want to live in a society that has art in it, I think. I can't think of many people who go through their whole day without interacting, you know, with the radio, with music, with the internet, with content in any, you know, whether that's podcasts, if people interact with the stuff, they want it. So maybe we should just do a better job of, you know, it's not going to solve the problem, but just being better at explaining what it is that we do and the value of what we do and being more forthcoming about that. And taking it a bit out of the shadows.
Yeah, you know, I sadly we're going to have to wrap up the conversation here shortly, but I think for me that's a brilliant sort of takeaway and it's an affirmation and a challenge, frankly, to the sector as a whole, I suppose, and to politicians and to policymakers and so on. You know, where do we put it? Do we put it on a pedestal? Is it low on the ladder? And as you were just chatting a little bit about that, I kind of thought, you know, where would we be without art? You know, where would we be? You know, it does seem like, oh, well, if you're actually trying to feed people, maybe art's not really high on your list. I don't know what Maslow would say. I'm not sure what Maslow really knew anyway, but that's for another interview and another time. But where would we be without it? Like you say, we're interacting with it in a variety of different ways, pretty much each and every day.
I understand that we're never, you know, there's lots of important things and I'm not suggesting that art is necessarily number one on that list. But I think that, you know, we're very modest as a sector, but I think that. Right.
Isn't art a pathway to change? It's about asking new questions. It's about seeing things in a new way. The purpose of art or one of the purposes of art is to peel back those layers and to go, you know, to go a little bit deeper into whatever it is. On a certain level, that's gotta be valid for no other reason than going a little deeper.
Yeah. And I think sometimes the hardest person to convince of that is ourselves. You know,
right.
Sometimes I step away from it and I talk about this report with people who don't work in the sector, they're like, oh yeah, no, this is great, this is awesome. And I'm always like, right, I don't always have to convince people it's important. Like they get it, they understand it. It's just, you know, we just maybe need to talk about it more and talk about the wide variety of things that happen in the sector.
It's good. You don't always have, that's a really positive note, so it seems to me, to end on. You know, you don't always have to convince people. It's important. They get it. That's nice to end on a positive note. Thanks so much for your time today. We've been talking with Lisa Fiorelli about a report that you can actually find all, I believe, 111 pages of it, but you don't have to read all of it because it's actually broken down quite nicely. It's called Making It Work. And why don't you just tell us, Lisa, where they can find that on the site, mm-hmm. and a little bit more about work and culture just before we wrap.
Yeah, for sure. So you can find the report, both the executive summary and the full length version, on workandculture.ca/research. It's the lead item on that page. We also put together, not everybody likes to read reports, so we put together a sheet of infographics also, that just, you know, very neatly and nicely and aesthetically pleasing interpretation of the data. And you can also find more information about us or any of the work we do on our Twitter, which is at the handle is Working Culture, or on Facebook as well, Working Culture.
It's great. And the report was called Making It Work, Pathways Towards Sustainable Cultural Careers.
Exactly. And it came out in May.
Thanks for your time today. We've been talking again with Lisa Ferrelli about the new report coming out of Work and Culture, Making It Work, Pathways Toward Sustainable Cultural Careers. Thanks for your time today, Lisa.
Thank you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.